All right, Exodus chapter 16. And we're taking a look at this particular chapter. We're not really going verse by verse, but of course you remember Paul said that the things written aforetime are written for our learning. And so we've been just trying to get the practical points from this particular chapter. And really this chapter in chapter 17, or at least the first 8 verses or so, have to do with the sin of complaining and grumbling, murmuring all the time. And that was the overriding sin that the Israelites had. Of course, they just got really worse as time went on with regard to other things. Even now, it's not mentioned much here, but we find out later that even now they have a problem with idolatry. But we'll get into that some other time. Even when they were in Egypt, of course, they were guilty of that. But so far as their character is concerned, they had this problem of complaining all the time. And when you think about complaining, it really demonstrates a negative character in a couple of different ways. It really just depends on who the target of the complaining might be. If it's towards God, then of course it demonstrates a lack of faith. Or even if it's towards the things of life, the things that you have or don't have, it's the things that God provide for us, and we should have faith that He provides for us. When we complain about those kind of things, then really it's a complaint against God. Or sometimes we find that the people of God complain about each other. Or, as we have said, complain about the leadership, and that demonstrates a lack of love in a lot of ways, even selfishness or even arrogance you might throw in there. So they're all negative connotations with regard to character. The Israelites were guilty of all of that. They of course, were complaining against God, and they were also their complaints towards Moses and Aaron. And so they just had this problem. And it's something that persisted throughout their history. They were stiff-necked, stubborn people who constantly, the first sign of trouble, would complain about somebody. and so that's what really is emphasized in these two chapters. And when you think about their situation and their complaining, their grumbling, murmuring, first of all, it's amazing how quickly it can come about. And again, as I said a few moments ago, remember, things written aforetime, written for our learning. So, and we have to be on guard about this as the people of God today. I mean, it can just rise so quickly. When you look at verse 1, you remember we saw that it makes reference to the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. That's where they are time-wise, so you're talking about just a month when they had that glorious exodus from Egypt. And already they're just complaining about the lack of food that they have. And again, it's just been a month. Like, they do have a little crisis going on here, but they're not starving. And remember, there's over 2 million of them. And so they're going to have some food provided, and they are, we know from other passages, they've gotten to the point where they're hungry, but again, they're not starving. Like, it's been a month since they left Egypt, and they had some resources, we know, and so now it's kind of become depleted or getting there, and the first thing they do is complain. But it's just amazing how quickly that can happen. In the Lord's church, those who are elders particularly know how quickly things can be going real good, and then all of a sudden, just like that, there's complaining. But there's a second thing about complaining that we find even here, and that is it's very contagious. And that's why I'd encourage you and try myself not to complain all the time, because, you know, people pick up on that, and it spreads so quickly. Here at verse 2, it makes reference to the whole congregation of the people grumbled against Moses and Aaron.
probably hyperbole, you know, again, over 2 million people. But the majority of the people, and we just know by nature, just by life, what didn't happen. It didn't happen that they all just started complaining at exactly the same time. Of course, that didn't happen. But someone started complaining, and you know, someone else listened, and it just kind of picks up, and it spread throughout the whole congregation. That's just the way complaining works. And complainers love other complainers. It kind of, you know, it's like, you know, that preacher, you know, he's so long-winded, that preacher. He just preaches so long, and you complain, always complaining, and someone else hears that, yeah. And then they join in complaining, and sometimes it's not even the same complaint. Like, and he's so shallow, too. You got a big problem. You got a long-winded, shallow preacher. And then someone else, and then all of a sudden they're complaining together. Now you got two people with two complaints, and other people pick up, and they pick up on something else, and next thing you know, it just spread, and it could be anything, whatever the complaining is about, and you start complaining about nonsensical stuff, illogical stuff, and that's exactly what happened with the Israelites, and it spread throughout the whole congregation. And then they started basically making things up or just having these wild ideas and accusations against Moses that they were led out to the wilderness to kill them. You know, that was preposterous, of course. I mean, really? But in their mind, this is what happens with complaining. It just spreads like a wildfire. And so it's contagious. And it's carnal as well. You think about what were they complaining about? Was it something related to their souls? Something related to their relationship with God? No, it was food. You know, it's just something physical. And you think about those who are complainers, even in the church. Now, keep in mind, I'm not talking about just having a complaint. Everyone, you know, all of us have had a complaint here and there. I'm talking about those who chronically complain, those who consistently always finding fault with something or someone, always something to complain about. And generally, it's carnal in nature. It's some kind of demonstration of carnality. And so that's what happened with these Israelites. Again, they're complaining about the food. And they're thinking back to Egypt and what they used to have. And no doubt that was even exaggerated in their mind. Like they didn't have it good in Egypt. But they're thinking, like, acting like it was just great. We would have been better off back in Egypt. And so just the nature of the complaining. And so we have to be careful as we think about being the people of God today. Do you fall into the category of a constant complainer? And if so, what's the nature of it? You know, again, you have to be careful that it's not just with regard to the people of God, but when you're complaining about what you have and what you don't have, that's a complaint against God. Where do all good gifts come from? From heaven, from above, James says. And sometimes you don't even recognize that. You remember here in this context, down at verse 8, Moses said, when the Lord gives you in the evening meat to eat and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your grumblings that you grumble against him, what are we? Your grumbling is not against us, but against the Lord. And Moses was right about that. Lack of food, it wasn't Moses and Aaron who provided food for them. They should have been relying and trusting on God for that, but they demonstrated their lack of faith, like as if God wasn't going to take care of them. And, of course, he does. And so then the rest of the chapter, as we say, really it has to do the primary thing with the manna that God provided for them. And when we stop and think about this manna, there's a lot of messages that again practical points that come out that we can apply today. And when you think about God providing this manna, the first thing, really the predominant idea in the chapter is the mercy, the compassion of God, the grace of God. Did they deserve manna? No, they deserve punishment. for their sinful complaining. And God could have rained down fire and brimstone, and he's known to do that. But instead, at verse 4, he tells them he's going to rain bread from heaven for them. And that's just the compassion of God right in the midst of them misbehaving so badly. I mean, you think about if you're God, all-powerful, their creator, and he's already done so much for them. And now they're just complaining and complaining. Well, I wouldn't have been surprised if God would have sent down fire to consume them. But God is a patient God. And by nature, he's a providing God. And so by grace, he gave them what they needed. And again, things written aforetime, we know. They're to instruct us, to teach us. Do we serve the same God today? You think he's less of a provider for us today than he was for the Israelites in the wilderness? No, God is going to provide for us. We can have confidence in that. When we doubt that, again, it demonstrates a lack of faith, just like the Israelites, for no good reason. God has consistently provided for us. And we should appreciate that. It's just who he is. I remember in the book of Philippians, in Philippians chapter 4, Paul, as he thanks the Philippians with regard to their giving, what Paul says. And in fact, as you turn over to Philippians chapter 4 is where I want to read. But even before I read that, in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, I'll just read this very quickly here. It says, and we want you to know, brothers, about the grace of God that has been given among the churches of Macedonia. Now, that would be, Philippi would be in one of those churches. As you realize your geography there, where Philippi is located. And so, but he says about these churches in Macedonia, for in a severe test of affliction, their abundance of joy and their extreme poverty have overflown in wealth of generosity on their part. For they gave according to the means, as I can testify, and beyond their means of their own accord. So now just think about it. These churches in Macedonia. They weren't rich. They, in fact, Paul says they're in severe poverty. Philippi was one of them. And they participated in giving to the poor saints in Jerusalem. And now in Philippians chapter 4, on top of that, we find that they were helping Paul and support his ministry personally. They were sending money to Paul. And so in Philippians chapter 4, Paul is very much aware of all of that and the sacrifices that they have made. And so he says, I have received full payment. Verse 18 of Philippians 4, I have received full payment and more. I am well supplied, having received from Epaphroditus the gifts you sent, a fragrant offering, a sacrifice acceptable and pleasing to God. Then verse 19, and my God will supply every need of yours according to his riches in glory in Christ Jesus. So here's a group of people who are in poverty. They're poor themselves. They're thinking about the poor saints in Jerusalem and contributed to that. They were willing to give to Paul so that he was well supplied. And there was a time when they were the only church that were given to Paul. And Paul, in trying to encourage them, Paul is saying what is still very much applicable today. God will provide all your needs. In fact, if you go back over, I'll not do it now, but back over in that 2 Corinthians and dealing with the monies that went to the poor saints in Jerusalem, one of the things he told the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, it basically, I'm not quoting it verbatim, but basically told them, you can't outgive God. You're not going to go poor as long if you give with a cheerful heart and all of that, you're not going to run out of supply. God will take care of you. But you have to have faith to believe that. And we ought to have it. You know who didn't have it are the Israelites. God had already again done great things for them, and they think somehow that he just provided them water after they complained and complained about that, and now somehow they think God's going to let them starve in the wilderness. And they're so delusional that they conclude Moses has taken them out there to kill them. And so, you know, when you just don't have your mind in the right place, it just ends up terrible so far as your relationship with God and spiritual things are concerned. You just start thinking crazy things. And that was the case with these Israelites. And so we think of compassion. God, they didn't deserve it, but God, in his mercy, his kindness, he provided for them. And then the second thing, and we just started to mention this last week, I think, but the importance of obeying God, keeping his commandments, that really was behind this whole business of giving the manna. And I'm not saying, God, listen, that God was not going to let his people starve, as I said a few moments ago. He was going to give them manna no matter what. I mean, he was planning on that, I should say. I wouldn't say no matter what, but he was planning that. Like, do you think the only way they were going to survive is if God got involved? Do you think God wasn't going to? That's why their complaining was in vain. It was a waste of time. It was inexcusable. God would provide for them. But a part of the providing for them was to see, where is their heart? Are they willing to obey me? And if you look at Exodus 16 at verse 4 again, when God says he's going to rain bread from heaven for them, he says, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. And that was a real part of this. God was going to test them. And then we see that most of Exodus chapter 16 has to do with the instructions that God has given them on how they're to gather this manna and store it and use it, how they were going to do that. They had to follow precisely what God said. I think we read last week Deuteronomy chapter 8. If you weren't here, let's just read that again and emphasize it just a little bit more than we did last week. We just read it in passing last week. Of course, this statement from Deuteronomy chapter 8, we're more familiar with it from Matthew chapter 4 when Jesus was being tempted of the devil, when he speaks of not living by bread alone. But in Deuteronomy chapter 8, notice again, the emphasis is on commandment keeping. Commandment keeping. And God has always been a God that demands that his commandments be kept. Why should we be surprised by that? In all of his sovereignty, in all of his greatness and power and strength, he's our creator. Why wouldn't we expect God to demand that we obey his word? I'd be shocked if that wasn't the case. And it is, and he always has, and he always will. At verse 1, Deuteronomy 8, the whole commandment that I command you today, you shall be careful to do. Now, think about these words again. Be careful when it comes down to keeping the commandments of God. It's not anything to take lightly. You be sure that you keep my commandments. You be careful to do it. Why? That you may live and multiply. Who said that commandment keeping isn't a part of salvation? It always has been. Even this is dealing more in the physical realm, but it has always been. Keep my commandments. Be careful to do it so that you may live and multiply. In other words, so that you will reap the benefits of my blessing. I've often said, God, there's many passages that demonstrate God wants to bless us. That's always been the case. In fact, in one place, I can't remember exactly where it is, but God told the Israelites, they had promised after a demonstration of God's power, they had promised that they were going to keep his commandments. They were going to be the kind of people that God wanted them to be. And God's response was, You know, I would that you would follow through on that so that I can bless you. And that was God basically saying, yeah, that's just talk. You know, that's just talk. They saw a great demonstration of power. So, oh, yeah, we're going to obey you. And so, yeah, I wish that were going to be the case. God knew it wasn't going to be, and it wasn't. They didn't. But the reason he stayed, I would that you would do that so I can bless you. And that's who God is. He wants to bless you. He wants to bless me. But if we're going to really be blessed by God, particularly on an ongoing basis, and reap the benefits of his providential care, if we're going to live and multiply, so to speak, we have to be careful to keep his commandments. That's just who God is, and he's all, that's who he has always been. And so verse 2, he says, and you shall remember the whole way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness. So this now is at the end of all of that. That he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you and let you, and this is interesting, and let you hunger and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. And that's what Exodus chapter 16 is all about with regard to the manna. We know it from this passage. And it's very interesting, isn't it? It is to me that God says, I let you hunger. Like God at any time could have sent that manna from heaven. Long before he did, he could have done that. Before they even got close to running out of any supply, he could have provided manna. He could have brought in quail, whatever. He could have done that. But he let them get to the point where they're a little hungry because he's testing them. And he wanted to make this point. You need to understand, you don't live by bread alone. And that's why in Exodus 16, when it came down to manna, again, God could have worked that any way he wanted to. But he set rules that were very precise just to see if they would follow. I wonder if God is doing that to us today through his word. You wonder why this or why that. It's the argument that we always make with those who deny the importance of baptism. Like, why in the world would God arrange it so we have to be baptized? Could it be? He just wants to see. He could have come up with some other way. He just wants to see. Who's actually going to do what I tell them to do? For no other reason, it doesn't matter if you understand or understand the why or anything, you just do what I tell you to do because I'm telling you to do it. And how many people in the religious world fall into that category? A lot of people would deny baptism for no other reason. They don't see the use of it. Why would God do that? That's none of your business. He did. He did. Why did God make it so that manna wouldn't last through the night? You think he could have provided some manna that would have lasted for weeks? Of course he could have. Why do you make us get up every morning, Lord, and regather more manna? Because he wanted to. That would demonstrate some faith. Every night they had to eat all the manna and have faith that God would provide some more. And God did it like that because he's God. He does what he wants to. And he was testing them. Commandments are extremely important. Then one more thing with the manna. And I made mention before that the manna was a type. And so it we can compare it. And the one, of course, it was a type of is Christ. And the reason we know this, because over in John chapter 6, and at verse 30, John the 6th chapter, and at verse 30, Jesus brings all of this up. John chapter 6, and at verse 30, so they cried to him, then what sign do you do you do that we may see and believe you? What work do you perform? Our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, as it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat. Jesus then said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, it was not Moses who gave you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. Now, he's not denying, Jesus obviously not denying the account in Exodus, of course. But he's just making the contrast between that bread, that manna in the wilderness was just physical and would help them physically. But he's the true bread because he's the bread that leads to life. At verse 33, for the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. And then over and over, you remember in the context of John 6, he speaks of being the bread of life. And the Jews didn't like that. In fact, they followed him until he started speaking like that. Then they went back and walked no more with him. But he's the true bread. So that manna then was just a type of something greater to come. And we don't have time tonight. We could talk about all kinds of things that comparisons that could be made with regard to manna in Christ. Why in the world? How would manna be a type of Christ? Well, for one reason, it was a gift from heaven. What was Jesus? A gift from heaven. And again, just like I said earlier, the Israelites didn't deserve it. Who deserved Jesus? Nobody. None of us. And so that's a good comparison. That manna was meant to give them strength to live. That's Jesus. Remember Philippians chapter 4, verse 13? Where did Paul say who was his strength? It was Christ. He strengthens us. He gives us the ability to live, not physically, but in this case, spiritually. Without me, you can do nothing, Jesus said in John chapter 15. And so we see that comparison. And I'll tell you another comparison that may not come to mind, and there's just all kinds of things you could talk about with this, but they were both despised, which is an amazing thing, but it got to the point during the wilderness wandering that the Israelites despised the manna. Numbers chapter 11, I think it is. Turn over there just for a minute. Numbers chapter 11. And at verse 4, it says, now the ramble that was among them had a strong craving. And the people of Israel also wept again and said, oh, that we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt. There they go again. What is the source of their problem? A lot of times is they just couldn't get Egypt off their mind. Don't forget, Egypt is a type of the world. And again, things written aforetime. We should learn from these things. And sometimes we want to go back to the world. But they had Egypt on their mind. We ate fish in Egypt that cost nothing. The cucumbers, the melons, the links, the onions, and the garlic. But now our strength is dried up and there is nothing at all but this manna to look at. And that's pitiful. Remember, this manna was a gift from God. He, by his grace, by his mercy, because of his compassion, he's providing for them. And now they despise it. Well, that's like Jesus. Like Jesus was a far greater gift than that manna ever was. And yet he came to a world that knew him not. He came to his own. Even they rejected him. And today, the world continues to despise Christ. Read Isaiah chapter 53. That's what that's all about. The suffering Savior. And how he was rejected and despised and esteemed not. Kind of like the manna. And except it's far worse with Christ. So a lot of lessons we can learn from Exodus 16. All right, well, let's jump to chapter 17. And Because, again, at least the first several verses, it's the same thing. They haven't learned anything. They continue to complain and murmur. First sign of trouble, they start complaining. So here we are in chapter 17. And all the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. And when you read other places, like in Numbers, they made a couple of stops before that. But they end up at Rephidim. But what happens at Rephidim? But there was no water for the people to drink. So how are the Israelites going to act now? Here they are again. They're in a situation, they don't have enough water. There's no water to drink. What are they going to do? Well, we know what they should do, right? No water, no problem. We've already been in this situation. God provided. Then we needed food. God provided. There should have been no doubt in their mind at all, but that God would provide. But here they go again. They haven't learned much at all. Verse 2, therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, give us water to drink. And Moses said to them, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? And so, again, they're approaching Moses like he has the ability to fix things. They don't realize they are really quarreling with God because he has just provided for them. Again, not much time has passed at all. Like these are this is days later. I don't know exactly how much time, but they're still within that two-month period of time. And so here they are, and they're just right back to the same old thing. You know why? Because their mind is still on Egypt. I can tell you right now, just again, a practical application of all of that. There's no way that I could be the kind of Christian that I should be. There's no way you'll ever serve God like you should if your mind is on the world. Like, you have to give the world up 100%. You got to let it go completely. If there's any part or portion of the world that is bogging you down, you'll never be what God wants you to be, ever. And you'll find yourself just making bad decision after bad decision, just like the Israelites. Like, it's hard to fathom here that just days later, they're in a situation with no water, but they should know without doubt there shouldn't be one of them who is doubting that God is going to provide for them. But instead, again, as a whole, they complain and quarrel with Moses because their mind or on the fish and the melons and all that stuff back in Egypt. And it's just ridiculous, but that's the way it is. But it's not, it is, no matter what, it is ridiculous, but sometimes we're just like that because our mind is on the world. Remember what Paul said in Galatians chapter 6, the world is crucified to me and I to the world. You know, why was Paul such a great Christian? One reason is he gave up the world, and on his part, that would include Judaism and all of that. He gave that up completely. Right? He wasn't homesick. He didn't have any thoughts of going back. None of that. The world didn't bog him down at all. He crucified the world. He put it to death, and he was free to serve God completely. That's the key to true discipleship. That's the key to being the kind of Christian that all of us should be. Got to leave Egypt. Put that in the rearview mirror. Look forward. And that's what God expects. But they couldn't do it, so they complain. And notice the extent of it. It says, but they answer, you know, why do you test the Lord? Here's their answer. But the people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? Same old cry. Same old cry. But we don't really see the extent of that until Moses brings it out at verse 4. So Moses cries to the Lord, what shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me. Can you imagine that? There's one passage we have seen earlier on. I think right after they they had crossed over the Red Sea and all of that. And the record said that they now had faith in God and Moses. Remember that? And now all of a sudden they had renewed confidence. That wasn't all that long ago. How quickly we forget. And now, realizing that Moses was the one leading them for God, they're ready to pick up some stones and kill him and stone him. And, I mean, they're thinking, all because of such a lack of faith that God's going to provide for them, and somehow they think God's going to let them die of thirst in the wilderness. It's just amazing. It's really amazing. But Moses did the right thing, didn't he? And this is consistent with Moses. I mean, how do you deal with the people like this? Well, the first thing you ought to do is go to God. And that's what he does. So he cries out to the Lord. And what does God do? Now, finally, he's going to rain down some fire and brimstone upon this stiff-necked people. No, here's the compassion of God once again. The Lord said to Moses, pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock of Oreb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the name of the people of the place, Massa and Meribah. Massa meant to test, and Meribah meant to quarrel. Because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, and because they tested the Lord. Now listen to this. They tested the Lord by saying, is the Lord among us or not? Like, all of that didn't come out in the original conversation. But this, as they were complaining, you think they weren't complaining against God? This is what they were saying to Moses. Like, is God even here? Is he with us or isn't he? And your God in heaven, after all that you have done, listening to that. Yeah, if I was God, I'd be tempted to throw down some thunderbolts here and there. No, but no, he's merciful. And he does what he does by nature. He provides for them water. And so, again, just a bunch of complaining. Let's make sure that we learn from that we're not like them at all. All right, as we start verse 8, we see an interesting development there where Israel actually has to fight a little bit with Amalek. And so we'll talk about that on next week.